Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the SITREP podcast from BFBS. Amid all the talk about defence spending and strengthening Europe's capability to defend itself, we're often reminded that during the Cold War, we typically spent 4 to 5% of our national income, GDP, on defence. So we thought it was worth a history lesson to consider what that money actually bought us in the Cold War and what we did with that military capability. Of course, times have changed a lot. Back then, countries like Poland and Estonia were part of our sworn enemy, the Soviet Union. Well, now they are our staunch allies who we help to defend. But there may still be some useful insights from our defence spending and posture 40 or even 50 years ago that could help us today. And so Professor Michael Clark and I have been talking to the historian Ian Sanders, host of the podcast Cold War Conversations.
Sort of 1984 was the peak of military spending with the UK during the Cold War at 5% of GDP, which is obviously the target that our, I was going to say allies across the Atlantic, but it's a bit questionable at the moment, are looking for us to spend. And at that point, we had the British Army of the Rhine, which was about 55,000 troops stationed in West Germany to deter a Soviet invasion. The RAF was probably double the personnel it was at the moment. And similarly, the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy had significantly more ships at that point and was really detailed with covering the North Atlantic and the Arctic and countering Soviet submarines that would be probably attacking NATO supply lines. Now, in addition to that, we had our nuclear deterrent, which in the 80s was the Polaris nuclear missile submarines, now superseded by Trident. There was also intelligence and espionage work with GCHQ working with the Soviet Union and MI6 running espionage operations in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And Berlin was a key factor in intelligence operations, and I think it's important to note that there was a British unit called BRICSMIS operating at this time, which was under treaty able to roam East Germany monitoring Soviet and East German troop preparations and therefore keeping the Cold War cold, you could say. The Soviets had a similar agreement where they had a unit that could roam West Germany as well, monitoring our troop movements. But that's sort of like a quick summary of essentially where we were at militarily during the Cold War.
And as a whole, how big were the UK's armed forces then? How many people did it add up to?
So in 1984, the UK armed forces was 326,000 personnel.
Wow.
In 2024, it's reckoned to be 138,000.
Yes, so considerably bigger than it is right now. And you mentioned 55,000 soldiers in Germany. What were they all doing, Ian?
So they were there to deter a Warsaw Pact invasion. So there were significant armoured units and infantry units. You know, we actually had divisions then rather than now. You know, the UK Army would have difficulty mustering anything like the firepower that we had then. The British were assigned a particular sector of West German defence. So you had the other allies, such as the US, with a very significant force in Europe, obviously the West Germans, but you also had the other NATO allies, such as the Belgian and the Dutch, involved in that forward defence of West Germany.
And Mike, how does the balance of the Royal Air Force and Navy and the Army back then compare to it now in terms of numbers?
Well, it was about the same proportions in that the Navy and the Air Force together made up about a similar number to the Army. And that's roughly where it is now. I mean, there's, you know, 30,000 in the Navy, 30,000 in the Air Force, and the 70,000 in the Army. So it's roughly the same sort of proportions. The Army is about the size of the Navy and Air Force put together in personnel terms. But of course, they do very, very different jobs. And the famous cliche, of course, is that the, you know, in the Army, they used to say you equip the man. In the Air Force and the Navy, you man the equipment. Air Force and the Navy is about the systems, it's about the equipment, it's about operating very complex equipment, whereas armies are about equipping soldiers, men and women these days, to do the job that they have to do as individual soldiers, boots on the ground.
And was Germany pretty much the entirety of the front line?
Germany at the time, I mean, as Ian said, the British Army of the Rhine was the main single job, particularly of the army. I mean, the Air Force also had the TAC Air, Tactical Air Force, which was part of the picture. The Navy had a different job to do, and the Navy's job during the Cold War was to look after the idea of American convoys coming across the Atlantic. And they used to conduct these reforger exercises pretty well every year. And they were exercises in which 150,000 troops would come from the United States to Europe to make sure they could do it. And so the Navy's job was to protect the convoys that would be on their way in the event of crisis. And the Army's job was to hold off Soviet forces for as long as possible. And the Soviets had a view that they had to punch through NATO forces inside 3 or 4 days and get to the channel in a massive blitzkrieg, because then they would get to the channel before we had the ability to launch nuclear weapons, before we could have made that choice. Now, funnily enough, Soviet generals didn't believe they could do this. They thought it was impossible, and it was impossible. It would have been impossible for all sorts of reasons that we could spend all morning talking about. But it was the only strategy that made sense to them. It was the only strategy, just like the Schlieffen plan in 1914. It was a stupid plan, but the only plan that Germany had was to attack France and Belgium first in order to make war on Russia. And the only plan the Soviets had was to try this impossible blitzkrieg to get to the channel before we could use nuclear weapons. And so that was what the game was all about. Could we reinforce to stop them getting to the channel, or would we have to go nuclear early if we had the decision-making ability and the determination to actually use nuclear weapons, because we weren't strong enough conventionally to hold off these massive Russian tank armies that would have punched through. Undoubtedly, they would have punched through, but they would have then got stuck in the urban areas, which didn't exist really in 1945. But believe me, by the 1970s, Central Europe, the middle of Europe, was much, much more urbanized, and tank armies don't punch through in the way that they would have 30 years earlier.
And Ian, in terms of kit back then, how much was it about trying to have a technology advantage over your opponent? And how much of it is just about having the biggest bang?
Technology became far more important in the 1980s. There was more of these light anti-aircraft weapons that would have been really, you know, effective against Soviet tank units. And I think that the British Army's confidence in being able to, you know, try and make a big dent, try and be a big, you know, traffic bump or road bump to delay them, their confidence rose. But the technology that was available to try and balance that numerical superiority of the Soviets was greater the further you got into the 1980s.
And Mike, we talked a couple of months ago about how Afghanistan has shaped the armed forces we have today. Were our armed forces back then basically entirely shaped and equipped for the possibility of war with Russia?
They were, absolutely. They were structured on the idea that they had to be capable of going to war. And although they didn't go to war, the idea was they could do everything else with a bit of adaptation. So we could operate in Kenya, we could operate in Borneo, we could do all the post-colonial policing and peacekeeping operations were required, with a war-fighting force that could be adapted when you needed to do it. Then we got to the end of the Cold War, and the thinking went the other way, to say, no, look, if you're going to do peacekeeping, real peacekeeping, if you're going to do stabilization, you've got to train for it and equip for it. You can't just adjust to it. And so then we went the other way and said, OK, look, we'll structure ourselves around stabilization forces, around brigade and battle groups, and if necessary, we can put them all together and create a war-fighting force. Well, you can't. It's one or the other. And here we are now, back to the where we were in the 60s, 70s, to say, no, you structure for war, and if necessary, you take forces out of it to adapt to do other things. And of course, now that we're trying to structure for war, we find that we're finding that very difficult. We don't have the numbers, we don't have the money, and we're only halfway back towards being able to fight a war with our forces.
And on the equipment, Mike, our defence budget now, the biggest chunk does go on equipment. How did it divide up then?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it used to be, it was about a third, a third, a third. A third on equipment, a third on personnel, a third on, you know, running costs and so on. But it has changed, partly because, as Ian said, I mean, personnel is now so much less than it was. So the latest figures, I'm checking them up recently, actually, that on personnel, we now only spend less than 30% on personnel. It was 28% in the 22-23 financial year, and 42% on equipment, and about 30% on everything else, capital and running costs and so on. And so and that's the 28% we spend on personnel, that includes civilian personnel as well. So 28% on people, 42% on equipment, which I think is probably the most we've ever spent in proportional terms on equipment, partly because equipment is so much more expensive and we go for top of the range stuff all the time, even at very low numbers. But that's the nature of the current budget.
And Ian, how much did people believe we could get into a full-scale conventional war with Russia back then? Because it's tempting to think the assumption was if there was fighting, it would start and end very quickly with nuclear weapons.
Well, there's a genuine fear during the Cold War that a war could happen either by accident or design with the Soviet Union. And you know, certainly in the UK there, you know, you saw the rise and ebb of CND over the period, the campaign for nuclear disarmament. But I think as Michael said, the more you look into the Soviet side of things is that there was an uncertainty about what, you know, whether they could be successful. And almost a reluctance there. I mean, it's really interesting. When Gorbachev comes in, what you see is a change of doctrine when they come in. I've interviewed some East German personnel, who a tank commander, who told me that the doctrine changed in 1987, whereby they were told that they wouldn't be crossing into West German territory. They would only react if there was a NATO attack.
And you know, NATO never, ever had a plan to attack the Soviets, ever. The Soviets always believed they did. They believed those plans existed. I promise you, there never was. There never was, there hasn't been ever a plan for NATO to attack eastwards, ever. And yet the Soviets then and the Russians since have always believed that those plans existed. I promise you, they never have.
And Ian, just a final thought from you. What from the job of the armed forces in the Cold War is just relevant today, and how much of it is pretty much the same?
Well, I think that the role of it is completely right. The role of it is deterrence, is to stop a possible enemy attacking. The last thing, obviously, you want to do is go to war. And the situation we've got into at the moment is that, you know, it's not enough of a deterrence force as we had during the Cold War. We've still got the nuclear deterrent, but that's absolutely going to be the last option. You know, and the challenge today is this form of hybrid warfare we're seeing from the Russians, whereby they're not actually in armed conflict with us, but they're starting to drag through undersea cables and disrupt communications and try and hack into systems over here. I think those are the other challenges that we're facing, and challenges that were completely unforeseen during the Cold War.
Really interesting. Ian Sanders, thank you so much for joining us on SITREP today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
News, discussions and analysis. This is SITREP.